Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
How does a missing person case end up inspiring some of the most famous writers of our time? In 1946, Paula Weldon disappears from Bennington College and steps into the imagination of writers like Donna Tartt and Shirley Jackson. But who was Paula, and what do we actually know about her disappearance? This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, I have a quiz for you.
Oh, no.
What do Shirley Jackson's Hangsman, Donna Tartt's The Secret History, and the creation of the Vermont State Police have in common?
Am I actually supposed to know this answer?
I mean, I knew this answer.
Really? That's what you're going to say?
I am.
Oh my God. Now I feel like called out on this. How would I know this?
I don't know. But that's my opening for today, because it is possible that none of those would have existed without the disappearance of a young woman named Paula Weldon.
Okay. Okay.
So which is weird to say.
The same woman inspired both books?
Yes.
And the entire creation of the Vermont State Police?
Yes.
Yeah, that is kind of, it's kind of odd, right?
Yeah. Yeah, like, that these, like, particularly, you know, I know Donna Tartt's The Secret History is much beloved, and Shirley Jackson's Hangsman is, like, a little bit lesser known, and so I think, you know, it's interesting that those literary works wouldn't have existed without kind of this inspiration, but mm-hmm. also the Vermont State Police is an entirely different thing. So I'm going to make all these connections as we go along. So, but I'll start with Shirley Jackson's Hangsman, because we actually have a book club announcement to make.
Right. So Shirley Jackson's Hangsman is going to be our February selection for a book club.
Right.
Yeah. And it was like, it was a book that was already on, I think, both our radars before this.
Yes.
And then, so when you brought it up, I was excited to do that. I actually am not familiar at all with Donna Tartt's The Secret History. Yeah, have you already read that one?
So I have all of Donna Tartt's books in my collection, and I have not read any of them. But I'm going to read The Secret History. But yeah, so as a reminder, Vanessa and I do this book club. And if you support us on Patreon, you get an extra bonus conversation. So I wanted to explain a little bit about why Shirley Jackson based her book on her.
Okay.
Okay, so Paula Weldon, she was a student at Bennington College when Jackson's husband, Stanley Hyman, worked there.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're married. Shirley Jackson.
So Shirley Jackson's husband worked at Bennington College.
Mm-hmm.
And Paula Weldon
was a student there.
Yes.
Okay.
So this happens while they're there. And then this disappearance inspired her to create a number of works. I mean, like, most notably, like, there are two short stories, but it's also believed to have been the impetus behind the creation of Hangsman, our February selection. So I am really excited to dig into this classic. Like, I've never read it, right? But I brought up Shirley Jackson, and you were like, yes.
Yes.
Apparently, it's about this woman named Natalie, who is based on Paula, who attends a liberal arts college and then starts to lose her grip on reality. So I'm interested to see what the parallels are between them. So one of the things that we have also started to do is we're hosting a Storygraph read-along for this. So if you want to talk about the book throughout the month, and this is free, you just have to download the Storygraph app, which is a reading app, and you can join us in conversation there. So we have linked our read-along to our socials, but you should be able to find it in-app as well. So we'll ask questions, and there's just a space to interact with Vanessa and I about the book.
Mm-hmm.
With all that said, let's just jump into who Paula Weldon was and what happened to her that impacted all of these things.
Sounds good.
So, Vanessa, like many 80s and 90s kids, my fear of disappearing in the Bermuda Triangle was, it turns out, largely unfounded, just like my fear of quicksand and drugs in my Halloween candy.
But I mean, you really should still not do, like, get too comfortable with those things.
No Bermuda Triangle.
No Bermuda Triangle. Stay out of the quicksand and check your candy.
Okay.
Just, I mean, it doesn't hurt to be a little safe with some of those. Or is it just, like, so deep-rooted that I'm, like, telling you that you shouldn't trust any of these things?
I think that is...
Has it been pounded into all of us? Like,
yes.
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 Okay.
Yeah. But, like, while I, you know, didn't have to fear the Bermuda Triangle, you know, because of proximity issues.
You weren't just going to stumble upon it?
No.
You weren't afraid of flying over it by accident?
No. Like, little did I know that there is an area closer to me that I should have been aware of, which is Vermont's Abennington Triangle.
I don't think I've heard of this.
Okay, so we'll introduce everyone to this. So consisting of over 100 acres, this area of Vermont is roughly marked by the towns of Glastonbury, Bennington, and Woodford. So that's an area that's been long talked about in Vermont. The Vermonters are keeping this secret to themselves. I don't know.
Okay.
But in some stories, it's an area where there's an energy vortex. In others, there's sort of like a cryptozoological creature stalking the woods. Some other people have talked about how they believe this area is a portal.
For real?
Yes.
Like, do people, like, not hike in here? Or
people do, but they just say they have, like, weird experiences here. There's even allusion that Native Americans avoided this area because it was a place where the four winds meet. Hmm. But I haven't found documentation of this beyond, like, white people saying this. So I welcome some input from actual Native community members. But whatever the belief system, one thing that is true is that between 1945 and 1950, so this is just a five-year period, five people disappeared from this same area. One in 1946 was our Bennington College student, Paula Weldon. So let's get into Paula Weldon a little bit. Paula Weldon was the oldest daughter of her parents. Her father, Archibald, was an engineer working for Revere Copper and Brass Company. And most of the Weldon sisters were pretty close in age. So when Paula was 18, her sister Pamela was 16, her sister Stephanie was 14, and then there's a large age gap to Heather at age 5. So it's like a family of all
girls, and they're all kind of, well, not too spread out in age, except for that baby.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So Paula had graduated from Stamford High School in Connecticut and was just one of 150 women out of 1,500 applicants to be accepted at Bennington College, which at the time was a private liberal arts college for women in Bennington, Vermont. We kind of think of colleges as having these incredibly long histories, but Bennington at the time, it's only been open for about 14 years when Paula enrolled. So if people are not familiar with the Bennington name, Bennington then and now was considered a place to kind of rethink the liberal arts education, particularly in its focus on fine arts. It became a place to go to in the 1930s and 40s, for instance, for things like modern dance. And today it has like this really well-known summer program for writers that I've never applied to because I don't think they'll take me.
Aw, yes they would.
I mean, maybe they would, but they used to have this like sketchy, I don't know. Okay, anyway.
Okay, moving on.
Yeah. So it's really renowned in that regard. There are a few key things about Bennington at the time, which is one, they really wanted to remove barriers between faculty and students in an educational sense. So
what does that mean?
So for instance, you know, you might dine with your faculty or there might be social occasions where your faculty are there. And some of that is actually true in a lot of liberal arts institutions now. So like when I was at university, not at Bennington, but you would be invited over to your professor's homes. Mm-hmm. And that is not true in other universities that I've been to.
Okay.
Right. So socially more open there. And two, they also had this long break after each semester, and this would allow students to pursue other interests. So whether that's internships or jobs or to work on their art. So that's part of the Bennington experience.
Okay.
So according to my information, Paula wanted to study art. And so Bennington would have been a natural pick for her. And its outdoor location, just miles from the newly constructed Appalachian Trail, or at least the part that's known as Vermont's Long Trail, would have been appealing to Paula, who loved outdoor activities like swimming, bicycling, camping, and skating. But despite all that, she really didn't seem to be fully thriving at college. Those who knew her on campus would say she was extremely quiet, and socially she was described as not much of a mixer, rarely making any close friends with the other women on campus. She wrote a letter to a friend at home. In it, she described herself as just another bogged down Bennington student, and that, "I'd like to play, but there's no one to play with."
So she was feeling this loneliness that people were seeing in her.
Yeah. So she also seemed to be having some conflict with her father. And this really goes undefined, but apparently some of it came from her father kind of wanted to dictate what his daughter studied. This isn't really made very explicit, but there's also something that he would deny, stating that she'd written him a letter saying that she was looking forward to working at a branch of her father's business in structural design, which was his specific field. So I'm not sure. Things were not going great between them. This is very much alluded to, but with very few specifics.
Okay.
Now, in October, around the 18th to the 23rd, she had returned home to celebrate her 18th birthday. And when she got back, her roommate, Elizabeth Johnson, said that Paula seemed upset that she had wanted a bicycle for her birthday but hadn't received one. Around Thanksgiving, it was clear that her father, at the very least, expected her to return home for Thanksgiving and even sent her a check for $10 so that she could do so. Paula declined. She said she needed to stay at the college because college was in session the day after Thanksgiving. There has been some debate about whether or not this was true. The university at the time did say that, yes, classes were in session that Friday. Now, Elizabeth, Paula's roommate, gave many conflicting statements about Paula's state of mind, at least as it was reported to the press. But there are some questions circulating about whether or not Paula was depressed.
So, like, none of this was really documented that well, right?
No. So, like, there are these news reports, but then there are just as many news reports saying the opposite.
So do we know if she really was depressed?
Yeah, so one of the things about this case is that despite a lot of reporting on it and despite all these connections to this, you know, books and the Vermont State Police and all that, there is a lot of shiftiness in this story.
Right.
Yeah. And it's also, it's like, you know, who do you have saying things to the press? You have her dad. So you have a dad who's trying to interpret or not just what his daughter is experiencing, but like craft it in a way. Like we've seen this before in our, particularly mm-hmm. our college aged women who have disappeared when their families are talking, particularly in this era.
I was about to say this time period was big for that. Like, I don't know if I want to say it this way, but this is the way I'm feeling. It's like if there was a way for a man to control a woman, it was kind of like through shaping some of her existence. So, when we talk about it, it could be a partner, but often it's the dad.
Yeah. So we've kind of seen this replicated before. He's the one speaking primarily to the press, right?
Right.
So all of this stuff, though, brings us to December 1st, 1946. And again, here, the timeline is shifty, but I'm going to primarily use an interview with Elizabeth, the roommate, that she gave in 1953. This is 7 years after Paula was last seen, but this is one of the few times that Elizabeth was able to speak publicly about her experience directly to the press.
Okay.
Before then, she had said stuff. We knew she was talking, but it was interpreted by Paula's father or by the investigator, not directly from Elizabeth herself.
Okay.
So Elizabeth relates that that Sunday, Elizabeth and Paula were working at the same time for shifts at the dining hall. At 2:30, Elizabeth finished up her job and went back to study in her dorm room, but Paula wasn't there. Elizabeth just assumed that Paula had maybe gone for a walk. Now, in other published versions of this story at the time, these say that Elizabeth and Paula saw each other in the room and that Paula had stated that she was going to go for a walk without Elizabeth. And like, this is something they had done together, so Elizabeth felt this was a little unusual. But in this specific 1953 interview, Elizabeth says that she didn't encounter Paula in the dorm room. At supper time, Elizabeth went back to the dining hall. The two of them were supposed to be waiting tables again that evening, and she just assumed that she would see Paula there. She didn't see her when she got there. Now, Elizabeth did say that yes, she did think it was odd not to see Paula, but to be honest, she didn't look for Paula all that hard.
Okay, and they're roommates, but they don't seem close, are they?
A little bit. Like, so it's clear they have, you know, friendly interactions with each other. It's also clear that they, like, did do things like going for walks together. But it's also clear that they did things separately from one another. So I think what she's trying to say here is like, hey, like, I went to the dining hall for my job. We both would have been busy. I kind of looked around for her, right? But at this point, she's not even alarmed, right? Okay. So after finishing her shift, Elizabeth went back to her dorm room where she planned to study. And again, Paula's still not there. Around bedtime, Elizabeth was a bit alarmed. So this is where she starts to get worried. So Paula's not back yet. And she did think, okay, this is strange. She thought it was possible that Paula could be studying in the science building. In this, like the other earlier reports, it was reported that Elizabeth thought that Paula might be spending the night in another room. And this is why I said it's a bit murky about like what people thought and what people were saying. In either case, whether Elizabeth thought that Paula was studying or in someone else's room for the night, Elizabeth wasn't concerned enough to raise an alarm. Elizabeth said that she tried to stay up and wait for Paula to come in, but as Elizabeth said, I was awfully tired, so I went to bed expecting her to come in any minute. The next morning, Elizabeth overslept, and so she leapt out of bed yelling at Paula to get up. But when she looked over, Paula's bed was empty. Furthermore, everything was just as it had been the day before. Her sleeping bag was unrolled, and across it were some clothes. So it was clear that Paula had not been back for some time. Of this moment, Elizabeth said, I sat in my bed in complete astonishment. Then I rushed to the dining room. I asked the head waitress if Paula had been there last night or this morning or if she had a sub. The head waitress told Elizabeth, no, Paula had not been in. Elizabeth rushed off to the infirmary to see if Paula was there, maybe ill or injured. But the nurses there told her that the last time they saw her, she was walking past their windows the afternoon before, and they saw her wearing a red jacket and some blue jeans. Now, Elizabeth, she had her dining room job to do, so she went back to do that. And when she was done, she headed back to her dorm building to speak with the house chairman. Neither Elizabeth nor the other woman knew what to do in this situation, so they just began searching all the campus buildings for Paula. But it was to no avail. Paula wasn't in any of them.
It just seems so abrupt, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing leading up to it and no signs of anything, like, around her room or anything.
Right. Like, what are the clues?
It's what? There's no clues.
Yeah. Like, what we have thus far is her walking past the nurse's building.
That's it.
Yeah. Now, once alerted, officials began the search for Paula. By then, it had been over 24 hours since Paula was last seen. One of the things students were supposed to do was to sign out when they left campus, and there was no record of her doing so, even though she had, to their knowledge, done so every time in the past. There wasn't necessarily a reason to believe that she was off campus, but at the same time, the campus wasn't all that big, so if she couldn't be located there, then where was she?
Right.
It was well known that Paula liked to take walks and hikes, and this was likely weighing on everyone's minds on campus. The night before had been the coldest of the season. The temperatures were about 0 degrees, and 2 inches of snow had fallen in parts. The college president called her home to see if she had, for some reason, returned to Connecticut, but she wasn't there. This is when the local police got involved, including a Sheriff Peck, who had actually been voted out of office the month before.
Why?
I don't know.
We don't know? We don't know anything with this story.
Yeah. I chose not to dig into that because I felt like I would end up in some sort of rabbit hole. But you know, at the time, there was not a state police system in Vermont. So instead, policing was handled by a collection of various local departments, meaning that for the most part, it was incredibly fragmented and jurisdictions didn't necessarily have a lot of contact with one another. So by night, though, the campus community had gathered to begin to search for Paula. Paula was part of Dr. Lucien Hank's botany class, a class that had done a lot of field observations. So that just means that they went to various locations to look at different types of plant life. One of the places that had mentioned in class was a cave on Mount Anthony, which was about 3 miles from campus. Paula had mentioned that she was interested in seeing this cave herself, so it seemed possible that she had just decided to head to this location on her own. Even though the campus hadn't been made aware of her disappearance until that afternoon, a party made it to Mount Anthony and the cave by that evening. There was no sign of Paula. By Tuesday morning, her botany class began searching for Paula in the woods near the campus. They hit up many of the places they visited for class or places that people knew she liked to hike. Much of the rest of the campus community joined them. In all, as many as 370 students were scouring the hills. But again, there's no sign of her. By then, her father had made it to Vermont and was beginning to get as much information as possible from the college president, Louis Webster Jones, as well as state attorney, William Travers Jerome Jr., and the sheriff, Clyde Peck.
So you keep mentioning her dad a lot.
Yeah.
But she's got, like, a mom and three sisters, too. So where are they in all this?
Yeah, so this is interesting because they don't appear.
Well, I know there's one is little. One so is little. Like, let her off the hook. But like, where is what about the mom and the two big sisters? Like,
yeah, there's actually such little reporting, such little heard from the family about this. Even in contemporary stuff, it's hard to come up with anything that they've said. But basically what happens is when the college president calls to give the mom or the parents this news, like the mom essentially like collapses, right?
Okay.
And so she is actually under the care of doctors.
And has she been, or is this just because of this?
This is like, it seems to be in reaction to the situation.
Okay. Because she really hasn't been piping up much before this either?
No. So we're not going to hear from mom.
Okay.
At all. So it's like she is at home managing all the other kids, also in distress, and so dad takes control, and it really seems in general that the dad likes to have a lot of say in what's happening with her dad in Vermont. This is where rumors start to fly about, you know, where could Paula be or what could have happened to her. And one of the main questions seems to center on whether or not Paula could have eloped with someone,
because it's always the question.
It's like the secret romance or question,
like,
right?
Anything in like the 20s, 30s, 40s, obviously.
That's like the Sheila's secret romance.
Yes.
So her father is the one who, of course, answers this. He quashes this idea. And Archibald said, "My daughter may have had a love affair. It's true she knew many boys, but they were only chums that accompanied her to socials and dances. I know she was not serious."
How does he know? Because like, I'm not going to say, like, I'm not going to be the one that's being like, obviously, like, she ran away and got married. But on the other hand, how does he know about his daughter's love life?
Right. Like, yeah. Mm. So he does say, though, that there was a male friend from home that had asked to call on Paula, but this hadn't gone anywhere. So that's kind of where we are with this. But as many, like, missing persons cases, once the news, though, of Paula starts hitting the press, reports start coming in from people who have seen her basically all across the Northeast.
We'll be back in a moment.
Some of these reports have zero merit, of course, but as news starts reaching local people, a story of Paula's afternoon begins to emerge. I'm going to put these in chronological order in terms of a possible trajectory for Paula, but the reports didn't come in that orderly a fashion.
Okay.
So first, we have two other residents of Dewey Hall, which is the same dorm Paula lived in. They claim they spotted her. This sighting is documented in a much later interview, but essentially Patricia Beck and Mary Watson Fruitrich saw Paula on campus that Sunday. This report comes from Patricia, and she says that they were in her Model A and that they stopped to offer Paula a ride, and she responded, "No, Pat, I'm just out for a walk." So we have at least some
confirmation. And we know that happened for sure.
Everything
just seems so like loose.
Yeah, well, this is like a much later interview, and I just had questions about other components of the interview in general,
but this one sounds like a possibility.
It's a possibility. Okay. So I mean, take all of these with a grain of salt. So the next person to see her is Danny Fager. He's the owner of a gas station that was located across the street from the campus entrance. He said around 2:30 in the afternoon, he watched a woman come down the college driveway heading towards Highway 67A. He says he noted it because in winter, there were very few people who walked down the driveway from campus at that time of year.
Okay.
While watching her, she turned off into some woods near the campus entrance, then walked up to the top of a small knoll. Then she ran back down and headed down the highway going towards Bennington.
Okay.
The next person to see her is a man named Lewis Knapp. He's a building contractor who is driving towards Bennington on the North Bennington Flats when he saw a woman on the side of the road signaling for a ride not far from the campus gates. He says he slowed down to pick her up at 2:45 in the afternoon, and when she went to get in his truck, she slipped on the running board and he told her to watch her step. He said she responded cheerfully and she did inform him of her plan to go hiking, but she didn't say much else for the drive. When they were reaching Bennington, he asked her where she'd like to be dropped off. And she asked, "Are you going anywhere near Route 9? He told her he lived out that way, near the Furnace Bridge Road, and she said her plan was to go hiking on the Long Trail. So he told her he could take her as far as his house. He says that he last saw her, she was heading down Route 9. They stopped at the Knapp house, and Lewis Knapp's wife said that she knows it was 3:15 when he came in for supper because they usually ate at 3 p.m. He must have told his family about picking her up because, though Knapp didn't look out the window, his 15-year-old daughter did, and she didn't see anyone on the road. None of them thought anything more of the matter.
So he did tell his wife, but they didn't see
her.
Her.
Yes.
Do we think this happened? Do we think she was hitchhiking?
Yeah. So at this point, I'm actually have two lines of thought here.
Right? Okay.
So the first is like, do like this kind of like suspicion, this like nagging suspicion I have of Knapp.
Right.
And begins to bubble up. Like he's later than usual getting home and his daughter didn't actually see Paula when she looked out the window. Right.
Right.
So if you're questioning this, we would be among many people questioning this.
Okay.
Because at the time, like, apparently he gets under a cloud of suspicion at the time and like many years later. He would later say in an interview that the only reason he stopped for her that day is because in 1946, gas rationing had just recently ended, but he still believed in the philosophy, share the ride, that had been pushed during the war years. Now, he says, I was just giving the kid a ride. Okay. But as we're going to get into, he's not the last person to claim to have seen her. So.
Really?
And that's like what I was like, oh, okay, maybe.
Huh.
So the second thing I thought of as I was reading this, and I don't know if you had this feeling as well, but I was like, oh no, he last saw her at 3:15 in the afternoon.
In the winter, when it's going to be dark in like an hour?
Yeah. So we live in the same kind of geographic region as Bennington, and the winter months, particularly December and January, are the months that I struggle with because of the lack of daylight. So if you're in Bennington, Vermont on December 1st, you can expect the sunset is at about 4:19 p.m. So this is just about an hour after he dropped her off. So she's miles from the Long Trail. And granted, last light is a bit longer than that, but that still means she has zero chance of ending this hike or getting back to campus before it's dark. I also looked up in the moon phase because I was like, okay, it's a full moon and it's snowy, right? Like,
yeah.
But it was the first quarter moon, so that's going to provide little in the way of illumination on a forest mountain trail. So.
And then there's also the idea of, like, how long is Long Trail? Like, is it something that she's just, like, was going to go for like, 30 minutes? Or is it, like, a couple-hour hike?
Well, so what is even interesting to this is, like, Bennington College is miles away from the actual start of, like, the actual entrance, the way she could get onto the Long Trail.
So, like, how would she even get back? Like, what was she planning to do if that was the plan?
Yeah. And also of note here is, like, her jacket. She's wearing a red jacket, but it's, like, kind of more like a windbreaker weight. It's, like, pretty lightweight. She's got, like, kind of sneakers on her feet.
Not going to cut it.
No. Not in, no. She's not dressed appropriately. She's wearing jeans. She's not dressed for a significant hike in the winter. And like I go on like pretty long walks. I don't go up mountains because that's not my thing, but like if it's in the winter, like I am well dressed for that occasion.
Right.
Yeah. And that's when I'm planning like, you know, like a short walk.
Yeah, so this doesn't sound great.
No, like what is actually happening here, right? So how does Paula, who's like well acquainted with how dark it would have been in this rural area with outdoor lighting, how does Paula, who would be well acquainted with like how cold it is, make this decision to head to the Long Trail if in all of these things are a factor, right? Mm-hmm. The next person to see her was Ernie Whitman. He's a janitor for Bennington's newspaper. But on the Sunday Paula disappeared, he was returning from a camp in Woodford, and his friends Stearns Rice, Mary Rice, and Lyman Royce were with him, and it's around 4 p.m. He said a woman he believed was Paula approached them and asked for directions to the Long Trail.
So he's sticking with the Long Trail story too.
Yeah. So these are two separate accounts.
Okay.
Now, Ernie says he gave Paula directions, and then she asked how far the trail went, and he told her it goes all the way into Canada, though he'd personally only walked about 5 miles of it himself.
So it is a long trail.
Like, it is an actual, it's part of the Appalachian Trail.
Okay, so it's just so you can walk as long as you kind of want, and then you'd have to probably turn around.
Yeah. So he did tell her about 4 miles up, there was a fork in the trail. So Paula thanks him and then heads off. Now, apparently this exchange is witnessed by other people in the area, and Paula was spotted walking along the first mile of the trail. Walter Mould, who was one of the area residents, he says he saw her. He and his wife lived on East Main Street, and he claims he saw her walk by their house. Later, when Walter was 80, he gave an interview about this moment. He said it was gloomy, just starting to snow, and this girl was coming up the road, heading up to the mountain all alone, thumbing a ride. We thought it was very strange. I'm positive it was her. I understood some truck picked her up after that and dropped her off.
It's kind of a, I don't know, it's like they are consistently saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. But also, like, if that wasn't Paula, I am 100% convinced at this point that whoever that was disappeared too.
Like we have a situation.
We have a situation. This isn't good.
Yeah, so it's only later when he reads the local paper that he realizes the significance of seeing this woman. And that's when it clicked. He said everything fit. It was the time she went into the hollow. She was all alone. Her clothes. There's no question about it.
Hmm.
Now, despite these sightings and others, so there's other people in the hollow who do report in seeing someone. There are actually some who question about whether or not Paula was the one spotted that afternoon. Three other people were actually out in Bickford Hollow that late afternoon. So we have Steve Vince and Lawrence Powers. They were two Boy Scout leaders who were hiking up to check on an old Boy Scout camp. And Bernice, Lawrence's wife, was waiting for them. With a cold December day, Bernice recalls walking back and forth along the road in order to keep warm. Bernice also wondered if whether or not, because she was in similar stature and hair color to Paula, that she might have been mistaken for the other woman. The only difference is that she was wearing a brown coat, not a red one, like Paula. Further, Bernice said that if Paula had actually left Knapp's house after he picked her up from hitchhiking, Bernice would have absolutely seen her because she would have passed by Bernice. Both men were questioned during the investigation, but Bernice says that she was never contacted by police.
Now, is it possible, because there is like a huge range of reds and there's a huge range of browns, that somebody could say that a brown coat and a red coat, like, could describe one coat as being brown or red?
That's a possibility. We also have the possibility of, like, you saw someone, right? And then later on you read there's a missing woman in a red coat.
And now that brown coat in your memory
is now red.
Is now red.
Right. So memory is incredibly faulty. So right. Is there a possibility? And that's what Bernice is saying here.
But so is like color identification. Like a lot of time people will say like, oh, that's orange, when really like to me it looks red.
I know my husband and I have disagreements all the time on the blue, green, gray phasing.
Okay. Colors. So ours, my husband and I, it's always the orange, red, brown.
Colors.
So right away I was like, yeah, that would be something. I would be wearing brown and he'd be saying it's red. Like, yeah.
And so like what is particularly of note to me is Bernice is like, I was out there walking back and forth. Right?
She's like, I'm the same height. I have similar hair.
Yeah.
It's me.
But then alternately we have Ernie, who says like someone came up to him and asked how to get to the Long Trail.
Right. And then the guy who says he actually gave her a ride.
Right.
It's so weird.
Uh-huh.
Huh.
So this lack of follow through with witnesses plagues the investigation. Though countless volunteers were scouring the Long Trail and the surrounding areas, the investigation itself was really quite disorganized. At times, it seems like Paula's father is in charge, at others the college president, and at other times the sheriff.
Shouldn't it always just be the sheriff?
Yeah, that's not how it was going. So, for instance, there's some reports that a maroon-colored car was spotted in the vicinity of the trail and that there was a man and a woman inside. At times, the reports seemed to imply that the woman was Paula. At others, it was just like some other woman. But this car drifted in and out of the newspaper reports with little resolution to that story. Eventually, Elmo Franzoni, a state detective, is called in. The idea was that they could, you know, he could come provide leadership and experience that wasn't present in Bennington. Franzoni vowed to get to the bottom of this, and he interviewed Paula's roommate extensively. He doesn't learn much else from her.
That's it?
No.
Okay.
He also followed up on a few other leads. One of these leads was the car. From his journals, we know that Franzoni spoke to a man named Dan Murphy from Brattleboro. Murphy and his wife were traveling from Bennington to Brattleboro, Vermont that night, leaving Bennington at around midnight. The snow had picked up. So a few miles from the long trail, he became stuck and was putting chains on the car's tires. And so while he waited, his wife noticed footprints in the snow. Mrs. Murphy said she remembered it had started snowing around 9 p.m. that night, so the tracks had to be made after that. She said they were on the right-hand side of the road heading towards Brattleboro, and both she and her husband noted that they looked like girls' footprints made with flat-soled shoes. The couple got back on the road, but soon got stuck again, and they had to put more chains on to gain traction. There, they saw the footprints continuing up the hill before suddenly stopping. To the couple, this looked to them like maybe someone had gotten picked up in a vehicle. Could this have been the car that people were reporting, this maroon car? Franzoni never came to any clear conclusions. Another lead that was followed up on is reports from these three men being in the mountains that afternoon. Now, William Lazone, he owned a camp about 4 miles below the Glastonbury Fire Tower. He had not seen Paula that day. She had not passed by his cabin. But he did say that three service members, which were two sailors and a soldier, had stopped at his camp around noon that day and asked him to care for their suitcase. They planned to go further on into their hike. In his estimation, none of the men were suited for climbing the trail. They were not dressed for it.
Okay.
So William Lazone, he became concerned and was kind of paying attention to what was going on. And one of the reasons for this is because the year before, a man named Mitty Rivers, who was considered a skilled outdoorsman, was last seen near his camp. And you know, this is now a year later, and Mitty is still missing. So, in fact, Mitty Rivers is actually still missing today.
Okay, so this guy's like, these three are going to go missing next.
Yeah, so he's like worried for them. So he's paying like some extra attention.
Okay.
Right. Now, these three men were eventually tracked down, and none reported seeing Paula that day. So despite Franzoni's experience, all these leads are coming to dead ends. So while Franzoni is looking for facts, speculation was running rampant elsewhere. Paula's father began to suspect foul play, stating of his daughter, she was a careful planner, extremely organized about her personal affairs. If she had gone on a prearranged trip, she would not have been wearing blue jeans and sneakers. I think she was kidnapped. Now, his belief is supported by the fact that his check for $10 was still in Paula's dorm room. She had never cashed it, indicating he thought that she had no plan to leave. Because, like, you know.
Right. She'd need the money.
She'd need the money. Meanwhile, the Bennington president, who had previously touted his belief that she had gone hiking to never return, seemed to back up her dad's statement, saying, "We're considering the possibility she might have left voluntarily. On the other hand, she might have intended to come back from this hike and met with foul play. We have no reason to believe she was in any kind of pathological state. She had appeared gay and cheerful at the party she attended the night before of her disappearance." Now, during the first week of her disappearance, the college campus is actually closed and all of the classes are canceled. This allows the students and the faculty time to search for Paula. But on Saturday, December 7th, they actually open back up. This is the same day that her father abruptly disappears. Now, some reports state that he was hiking in the woods alone looking for her, but a more likely scenario is that he traveled to Massachusetts following a report that a waitress had seen her there in the company of an abusive man. Like every other lead, this proved to be without merit.
Wait, you said he disappeared. He comes back, though?
Yeah,
he comes back.
But everyone's like, where'd he go? And now, in many ways, this search, though, is a race against time, like, obviously because of the weather. But also, importantly, the college was set to close for the semester, and that meant the student body and faculty would be scattering. potential witnesses would be gone, and because of the long break Bennington had, they wouldn't be back for months. So despite all the searches, though, this does come to pass. On December 16th, Paula's father emptied the dorm room of all of Paula's belongings, placing them in the back of his Buick coupe. Before he left, he made the state attorney promise that he would call the Weldon family every day with updates about Paula's case. In the days after, there were still efforts to find Paula. A game warden, for instance, gathered a group of experienced woodsmen to go search along the Long Trail. There's also an effort to excavate a gravel pit near the entrance of the college after people had reported seeing a landslide at the pit on December 1st. The game warden also said that given Paula's interest in botany and the presence of twigs that looked like they could have been cut, he wondered if she had stopped there and had an accident. But despite hours worth of digging and the removal of thousands of pounds of gravel, Paula wasn't located. In the many years since, there's been plenty of speculation about what happened to Paula. In those years, some of the main developments seem to center around confessions. One was given more weight than the others. This is a 55-year-old lumberjack who told a friend that he was in the hollow the day she disappeared, and he tells his friend he knew where her body was buried. He would later claim he was just joking. But this was told to the acting village attorney. Now, this confession was always questioned because it comes via this acting village attorney who ended up being, like, weirdly obsessed with this case. So they're like, maybe it's just his obsession. Also, he seemed to be using it for some political clout. Like, I know.
Like, if he solved this, maybe. Yeah.
But the biggest development had to be on the impact this disappearance had on policing in the state of Vermont. Now, Franzoni said publicly, Vermont has no state police force and no official agency designed to cope with this type of case. Unless we can prove a crime has been committed, the state will have to relegate Miss Weldon's case to the files of missing persons. My men and I are in practically on a volunteer basis. We just don't have the authority to continue. We've tracked down every indication of foul play and we've run against a blank wall on every lead. Now, this was echoed by her father, who said, I know the police have done all in their limited power to find Paula, but Vermont has a definite lack of police facilities for handling this type of case, and something should be done about it. The parents of every girl in Vermont face the same situation, which I now find myself should their daughter disappear. Now, though Vermont had been in talks for several years about developing a state police force, it was largely blocked by local authorities who wanted to keep policing activities on a local level. With Paula's disappearance, there's a new push to change that. And it passed. So Paula is credited with the creation of the Vermont State Police. But Paula's disappearance was also capturing the imagination of artists. Again, Shirley Jackson was there watching this all unfold, and I cannot imagine what it was like to see the swarms of students and faculty set out looking for Paula every day. But the author, Donna Tartt, attended Bennington decades later, and she must have heard the stories about Paula, and those stories serve as inspiration for her novel, The Secret History.
I think it's one of those stories, too, where it's just, like, there's so many, like you said, like, the like, slippery and faded parts of people's memory. Mm-hmm. And then all of these accounts of, like, her on the trail. But then in the years later, having, like, all of these confessions. It's just, there's not any, like, one solid anything.
No, it's so insubstantial. Everything feels like it can't be held on to.
Right. There's, like, these speculations of a man. But who?
Yeah.
And, like, it's just, there's nothing. There's just nothing to go on.
Right. And then you add in just the idea of the Bennington Triangle, like where like weird things happen, you know, like
that kind of that whole realm there. And then just like, I don't, a lot of time we talk about these and I feel like I connect with the woman. Mm-hmm. I still don't feel like I know Paula.
Right. I mean, so very little, like I looked and looked and looked. Very little information about who Paula was or what her dreams are. Because you know that's like what I love to do.
Right. Most. And I was waiting for all that part. And it's just like, I still don't know Paula. The lack of like care, not care, but like the lack of like documentation of her mom mm-hmm. and sisters. There's no friends speaking up aside from her roommate.
Yeah.
It's just, there's nothing here.
Yeah. And so I end up saying stuff like, oh, she liked swimming and hiking.
Because that's all we have.
Right. Her dad wrote
I wish we just
check.
Had more. So it's actually making me very happy that two women chose to write about her.
Right. Like that she
that's
like,
something.
Stays in these like that's pieces something. Of literature.
Right. And then that the Vermont State Police is crediting their whole existence to her. Like mm-hmm. like she has a lot, but so little.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's there's so much about why she captured the imaginations, right? Because it's like so hard to conceive of someone who was there and just suddenly gone, particularly in a place like Vermont. But once upon a time, there was this girl who did just that. She set out from her dorm room, never to be seen again.
Dreamland Winters. Paula Weldon, 18, missing since December 1st, 1946 from Bennington, Vermont. Tonight, just as the December clouds pull over the mountain and tuck the cold moon from view, I'll dream you alive again. You'll be there, soft snowflakes catching the golden strands of your hair. You'll linger at the crook of the trail, where claw-marked beach record the passage of bears through the wilderness. You'll gesture to a small clearing where the fern fronds rustle as the four winds funnel down the mountain. With every long-limbed stride, you'll forge ahead until just the red light of your jacket flickers through the darkening trees. And then, even that disappears.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.
If getting more fiber and protein while reducing net carbs, sugar, and calories fits your health goals for the new year, get better macros in your go-to dishes with Hero Bread. From a quick 19-gram protein breakfast bagel to Taco Tuesday for your family, your favorite recipes are covered. They have sliced bread, tortillas, bagels, and more with protein and high fiber. And there's 0 to 5 grams of net carbs and 0 grams of sugar. To help hit your goals with easy swaps for your favorite bready dishes, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code HERO26 at checkout. That's 10% off with code HERO26 at HERO.co. All figures per serving of Hero Bread contains up to 18 grams of fat per serving. Not a low-calorie food. See nutrition facts at hero.co.